Thanks very much to all of you for coming along this afternoon, on this nice sunny afternoon when you could be sitting in the park or something like that. It's been a very great pleasure to introduce my friend Agiotis Baladou, all the way from Athens, to speak to us tonight about classical studies facing digital research infrastructures from practice to requirements.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to start by thanking you, Simon and Gabriel, for inviting me here, for putting this together. It feels kind of strange actually being here. I was thinking about it while I was walking to the Senate House. I was a student, a University of London student, for quite a few years. My PhD is on classics at King's, down at the Strand. When Gabriel asked me to send him an image for the poster, I chose this one. This one's a 7th century Temple of Apollo in Corinth, which was actually a large part of my PhD thesis. So I'm a classicist, ancient historian, classicist. And before I start, I'd like to, let's say, confess that I, throughout my thesis, I hardly used any IT tools. A year after I finished my PhD, I was employed by the Digital Curation Unit, which is part of the Athena Research Center in Athens, to work on preparing Daria. Daria is an EU project. The whole title of the project is preparing for the construction of the digital research infrastructure for the arts and humanities. So basically it was a project that preceded a bigger project. Collaborative, many partners across Europe from more than 10 countries, very prestigious institutions involved, like the Max Planck in Germany, University of Oxford, Göttingen, Germany again, and so on. What was Daria aiming at? We were trying to provide the foundations, set the basis for the design and the construction later for a digital infrastructure, whatever that meant, which would support scholarly research in the arts, humanities, and cultural heritage across Europe. Daria was, kind of a big umbrella embracing other smaller scale projects across Europe. I'm sure you have heard of bigger or smaller digitization programs that have run or are still running. Daria was aiming at complementing and supporting those projects. Huge effort on many different fronts, legal, financial issues of strategy, as well as a huge technological and conceptual project. Sources should become available long-termly across Europe, access to them. Scholarly research in the arts and humanities, Daria thought, should be supported throughout all of its stages, while at the same time attending all aspects of interdisciplinarity, of different methodologies, different approaches across the disciplines. At the moment, last February, Daria closed. The closing meeting was held in Berlin, and we entered the transition phase. We're hoping to move through to the construction phase at the end of the summer. So this is an ongoing project still. DCU, Digital Curation Unit, was part of the technical work packages within Daria. Our job was to develop a conceptual framework in order to map out user requirements for Daria. This model, which was as abstract as it sounds, would represent the actual information practices within humanities research. Apart from the model, part of our deliverable included an empirical study, I'm going to come back to that, of scholarly research activity. This was interviews, basically, with humanities scholars. The design of the study included the elicitation, the transcription and coding, an analysis of semi-structured discussions with humanities scholars. Our whole rationale at DCU was to focus on the user and his or her needs. We didn't want, some German guy said, I didn't know this saying. To a boy with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Yes, we didn't want that. We just wanted to design something from scratch, something that describes and applies to the actual needs of a humanities scholar. This looks much harder than it actually is. Our first task was to actually see what had already been done in the field. And surprise, surprise, there were studies around this area. It all started in the 1980s, where people started looking at the way scholars, usually social sciences scholars or scientists, interacted with information tools. And basically, the first thing that actually drew their attention was the way they searched, the way they were trying to find, to locate information, and the way they, let's say, played around with it. What did they do once they found what they were looking for? This was all in the 80s. It was in the 80s that people actually started spelling out that humanities research is a very solitary thing to do. It's a very lonely thing to do. In the 90s, early 2000, these people kept carrying on this information seeking, carried on research on the information seeking behavior of humanists. They started talking about named entities, entry points for research, proper names, places. What did they do? How did they find things? Did they use digital tools? Did they not? Very scant multimedia resources, but still, what did people used to do with them? Did they use them? And then, as we're going into like the mid 2000, 2004 or 2005, then we start getting studies that focus on disciplines such as history and art history. It's in a way, these studies are kind of, they are empirical. They're sort of the anthropology of scholarly research, in a way. Things started to become clearer in the 1980s. People actually noticed or had like proof that humanities research is interdisciplinary. Yes, it's been 30 years since then. We still talk about that. People kept being intrigued by the fact by how humanities scholars searched for the information they were looking for. They started analyzing notions like browsing, comprehensive searching, and then some more state of the art, some kind more nicer looking words like berry picking, chaining. These were all micro activities within searching, right? Berry picking, chaining, footnote chasing, reference chasing, citations, journal run. I don't know how many of you are humanists. Most of you, I guess. Well, to you, these may sound, you know, like the normal everyday things to do, but to people actually studying the way we work is a very different story. They actually did first-hand research on these kinds of activities. Annotation. This annotation, meaning the comments, let's say, you make on the things you find, how you organize them. Do humanists do that? Do they need tools that enable them to do it better? Questions that started, you know, coming up as people started looking at the way we humanists, classicists, historians work. And then there were the primitives. This is a notion, an idea, a word that has been challenged. Last year in June, in this seminar we held in Athens, Simon was there. Seamus Ross from the University of Toronto challenged this notion. He said, there's no primitives, there's activities, what are you people talking about? Still, these are processes, let's say, employed by scholars as a concept to identify low-level basic activities. 1993 was the first time somebody talked about them. You can see the primitives as they were expressed by Ellis, starting chaining, browsing, differentiating, monitoring, and extracting. Yes, this is what we do when we do research. And then John Answorth, in his very famous talk, the talk he gave at King's, I was at King's back then, I never got to see him, I was surprised, but he gave a talk at the Great Hall, King's back then. Were you there? You were. Okay, well, John Answorth rephrased or revisited these primitives a few years later. He discussed issues of discovery, annotation, comparison, reference, sampling, illustrating, and representing. So then again, you can see that searching, the very basic first principle I was talking to you just before, is there again, just in very different words. Starting and chaining and browsing is now discovering. And then the notion of annotating. Meho and Thibault, 3 years later, just three primitives. They said, it's all about access, networking, and verifying. Access, searching again. And then the latest study by Palmer and her team, 2009, just a couple of years ago, microactivities rather than primitives. They described scholarly activity in terms of workflow, really. Searching, collecting, reading, writing, collaborating, browsing, collecting, rereading, that's a primitive now, yes, assembling, consulting, and note-taking. These, they said, were what humanists do during their research, and this is not just what they do, but they do it all the time, repetitively, and at the same time. So we at TCU and the other Daria people, we were looking at those primitives and thinking, so is that it? How do we actually make any sense of that? How can we move from primitives to practices, and then from practices to requirements? We had to look at the actual people. We had to see how people really worked, how a philologist, how a classicist or a historian, how an anthropologist or an ethnomusicologist, all these people doing work in the humanities, how do they do it? How do they interact with the information? What differences are there between the way they do things? Do they just use digital resources, or do they employ other non-digital tools? I did when I did my PhD. I handwrote everything, for example. So we needed the evidence. But before the evidence, we needed a guide around it. So we developed a conceptual model. This was actually part of our deliverable, so we had to do it. But at the same time, it was a tool towards our very final task. Why do it? Because we needed a framework. Because we needed the tool of analysis, and we needed a guide to understand. What was the way to confirm this model? Well, the literature review I just went through, the interviews I'm going to come back to later, and the experts forum, which is this seminar Simon attended last year. How? We employed activity systems theory, applied the, is it CDOC or CIDOC, CRM model, and so what we aimed to produce was a map that explained not just who did what, but how this person did things. This scholarly research activity model is a conceptual model that encompasses, includes entity examples, such as the actor. The actor is me, a researcher, right? A research activity, like a literature study. Research goal, which is to produce a commentary of Homer. An information object, say if I'm an archaeologist, then this could be a pottery collection. A tool or service is an easy thing to grasp at the moment. Google Maps or Microsoft Word. A format, like a PDF or a Word document or a JPEG image. Or an audio file. And then a resource type, like an electronic document, a map or an image. And then the properties examples is what properties examples are really, these are the arrows you're gonna see in the model. I'm gonna show you in a minute. Properties examples are the verbs, the actions, the things that lead from one entity to the other, like has type, or creates, or searches, or curates, or refers to. Here's an example. A very, very simple example. Me, Ayati, I'm carrying out a literature study of Homer. This literature study follows a standard scholarly procedure of analysis and interpretation I have learned at university. For the purposes of this literature study, I'm creating this lit word document. I'm sure everybody's doing that, right? This document has a type. It is a Microsoft Word document. This Word document is supported by Word. Is that okay? Now, if we look at the model, this nice little story looks like that. Here's the actor. There's a research activity, this literature study carried out by him. This activity study follows a certain procedure you all learned at university. We create a Word document which has this format, and then it goes up there to the tool and service. What developers needed from us in Daria was tools and services, directions, guides of what tools and services humanists, classicists need. Is that clear? So that's the scholarly model. So you can see the arrows are verbs, and then the little white squares, these are the entities following the CDOC CRM model. That's why E, like right next to method, you can see E29, that's entity 29, that's part of a conceptual reference model. The interview. So what we wanted to do is gather information on as many actors as possible, as many humanists, active researchers as possible from across the humanities, so that we can break down their narrative, filling these boxes in as many ways as possible, so that we can get to as many tools and services as possible, or to as many suggestions towards tools and services as possible. The participants, who were these people? These people were just mainstream humanists producing valid research. They were you, they were me, they were people you know. They were people who knew about IT tools and used many of them. People who didn't, older people who just kept notes in nice little pads. We focused on classics and archaeology. These people could be professors. They could be early career researchers, PhD students. And their approach towards ICT tools in humanities research varied largely. Some of them were suspicious, some of them were enthusiastic. We took 24 interviews. Yes, We wanted to understand, we wanted to confirm or contradict what we had read in the bibliography. We couldn't, besides the number was small, they were just 24, we couldn't use it, use this evidence for statistical purposes or for any other quantitative research. It was just a qualitative research. The interviews were on purpose, they were designed as open question, conversational interviews, they were semi-structured. There were pros and cons to that. First of all, let me say that we included both practice-related questions, such as, how do you make notes? What do you do when you face terminology problems? How do you save your work? Where do you work? Which tools do you use? Do you use Google? Do you use Google Maps? Or do you use any other tools? How do you create a database, if you do? Do you use Access? Do you use Excel? Do you use Word? Do you just use, like, your notebook? We also included conceptual questions, like, how do you come up with a research topic? What is it that intrigues you? What puts you off? How do you start working? What motivates you? What makes you feel like you need to compare things? Or how do you feel about collaboration? Do you do it? Do you share what you come up with? Do you hide it at the back of your desk and hope nobody ever finds it? And if so, why? The pros of this kind of interview. People kept talking and talking and talking about the thing they liked to talk about the most. They started thinking about things they had never thought about before, like, why do you take your laptop in the archive but never take it in the storeroom of a museum? Why? Why is it different to you? Why is the storeroom of a museum or of an archaeological service in Greece, let's say, is it different to an archive? And if so, then why? People had to think about these questions. People actually had to think about more basic stuff, such as how do you trace a reference? Do you look at the footnote and then go back to the library and find the book? Do you check it online, see if you can find an extract online and see if you like the way the person writes? They had never thought about these questions. These were the pros. People kept talking and talking. Exactly, that was exactly what the problem was. How do you analyze this vast material? How do you transcribe it? How do you encode it, tag it? How do you use keywords? How do you extract keywords? What are these? And then what do you do with them? How do you go back here to fill those boxes? What are the words you put in there? It was a very painful job. It was time-consuming, hard, prone to very many mistakes. We had to go back and back again and check. And this is why we held this expert forum, the so-called expert forum, last summer in Athens, trying to present what we had found that far to people whom we trusted and whose work we appreciated, and ask them, are we on the right track? And then the boxes were filled with sometimes very concrete tools and services that are already there, and with some others that are not. Some of them that the developer said, you have them. Some others developers said, we're sorry, but, you know, you will have to wait before you have them. As soon as the model was ready, as soon as we had finished with the analysis of the interviews, then we had to work very closely with IT people. We formed a new team with computer scientists, and we worked together with them towards the user requirements. These fell within five key areas. the scope of information objects, access conditions, semantic interoperability, collaborative work, and information versus analysis analytical tools. Information objects. The first thing that comes to mind when you think of humanities research is its interdisciplinarity. It's the variety of objects a philologist or an archaeologist uses. These objects could either be primary data or secondary data. They could come in different forms, be of different kinds, and sometimes these objects, they could be a combination of other different objects that which is this combination the product of research. For example, if I'm writing a thesis on ancient Corinthia and I'm using text, I use image and I also use audio material, then the product of my research is a combination of all those things. This per se is another object. So basically, Daria has to embrace all these objects. It is imperative, they said, that we identify them. We have ways of representing them, managing them, so that they can be curated and enriched throughout the cycle of humanities research. And also, these objects, we have to have access to them. Access is another huge thing. I'm sure you know, especially archaeologists, they need to have access to their material. This is very difficult sometimes. They need to have hands-on access as well as visual access. Classicists, they do have to have access to text. They do have to have access to archives. They do have to have access to images of text, not just the actual content. And then you have legal issues, not just technical, heritage protection legislation, intellectual property issues. Just imagine the Perseus project. It's been going on for how many years, 30 or 25? A much bigger Perseus project where where you can have access to almost everything, or at least to as much as you can get. And then we didn't just want access to the primary material. We wanted to make sure that we, or at least try to have access to secondary material, to my thesis, to your thesis, to the book you wrote on this primary material. And then, how do you deal with issues of sharing? How do you deal with issues of trust? So this was not just a technical challenge. It is a much bigger thing. Semantic interoperability. This is very technical for me. Basically, issues of language, issues of different types of resources. How do you connect those things technically? How can you move from a text to a map, and from a map to an audio? How can you move from an ancient Greek text to the English translation? How can you move from an ancient Greek text to its English transliteration? How do you interoperate? How do you connect things located in different countries, different kinds of repositories, different kinds of archives? They're expressed in many different ways. Many different technical languages, different content. How do you do that? But this is a user requirement. People want to have that. And then, surprise, surprise, humanities research is not as solitary as they used to think in the 80s. Our empirical research showed that classicists want to share. They want to discuss, they want to have collaborative research environments, they want to have wikis, they want to have blogs. The digital classicists is one of those initiatives. They want those things. They are skeptical, but they want to move from that. How can you feel part of a community? How can you co-author, co-create? How can you confirm your findings? how can you discuss your interests or expand your research horizons in a way that protects you and in a way that protects others from you too? How can you encourage through a digital infrastructure such activities? How can you encourage participation? And then what tools do we need? Do we need other tools? Do we have enough? Technicians said we don't need other tools. We just need to make the most of what we have. Is that truth? And are classical studies in need of different tools than anthropology or not? Is archaeology the most scientific of the humanities, really, or not? Are philologists people who just work in dusty archives somewhere in the basement, or are they really need of more state-of-the-art tools? Who will enable them to make new starting points, to search things in different ways, to annotate and comment and collaborate in different ways? This is the work we actually did for Daria. It was very, very challenging. It's promising. We've been promised that technicians are gonna work on those things. They have the answers, they say. So construction phase starting in a few months, and then I hope we'll be back with more. So thank you.
Thank you. One thing that would interest me, one of the things, and knowing you when we were both students together at King's, one of your earlier comments was that you never used to use any technical methodologies in your research when you were a graduate student.
I used the word.
You used to use pen and paper like me, and you made a remark over people's notebooks, which is what I use, of course. Since you've been working on this Daria project, has this influenced the way that you actually do your research?
Greatly.
Yeah.
Greatly. I had no idea that there was such a thing as wiki, as in wiki. Okay. I think that the collaborative research environments, not just research, but collaborative tools, were the first thing that struck me. I didn't know such things existed. I had never looked for them.
What I was thinking of is that you would be a prime candidate for this. Somebody who was not used to using technology in your research and been involved in the creation of the research that's sitting behind Daria, and then having the opportunity to apply that yourself. I just wondered how you felt about that.
It was like, let's say, having spent years and years walking barefoot and your feet hurt, but you didn't know there were such things as shoes. You know? This was the idea. What I wanted to say is that I was the one responsible for the interview. I co-designed, and I was the one who actually did the interviews to people. And to me, what was the most challenging, but also the most charming thing about this project was that it was largely a communication challenge. You have to first of all, when you have a classicist just sitting across the table, and you say hi, thanks for agreeing to do this. Daria is the project I've been working on, blah blah blah. They used to look at me in a very, very curious way, as in, why do we need those tools? Are you gonna make our life easier? Our life is fine as it is. So this was the nicest thing of all, having to overcome this first reaction and get them to believe or to trust you when you tell them that there are computer people over there and there's you here, and you can actually meet somewhere in the middle and make something of that. Do you believe that this can actually happen?
My impression, knowing you, is that you're probably a very good choice of candidate for this, not being a terribly technical person, because I think in the conversation between a technologist and the researcher, you do need somebody in the middle. My finding is that my experience is that often people who aren't technologists, the language is different, to a non-specialist,
it's a different culture.
It tends to be very, very confusing, so I think perhaps you're a good choice. Anybody else have any questions?
If I was wanting to work on projects designing, you know, digital services of various kinds for humanists, which happens to be part of my job, how easy would it be for me to take your model and use your requirements model in the planning and design of?
You take about...
I mean, I'd like to shamelessly plagiarize you, because I think this is great.
Thank you. You wouldn't take this model. You would take an analysis, a discussion and analysis. I think it's a 200-page analysis of these slides, and you take it from there. The model was just a tool for us to for guidance and understanding, and it is a conceptual thing. You know, it actually enabled us to think from. To move from the activity to the procedure and then to the service. So you wouldn't, as a technician, as a developer, you wouldn't take this model and try to make sense of it.
I'm just saying, how would I apply your conclusions? I mean,
You'd work on better collaborative tools, better annotation tools, management issue. That emerged as a huge issue from our research. How do you manage? How do you create a database that makes sense for the future? Do you have something to offer? You as a developer, let's say, to help me organize my work better. These are the things that people ask. So this is basically putting it into just plain words for me to understand. This is what the user-centric approach gave us.
I'd be happy with the database, it makes sense in the present.
Perfect. database issues, and management issues, and collaboration issues were the flashing issues that emerged. Searching, surprise, surprise, has been resolved in the minds of classical studies researchers. We've moved from that.
Good. And now we're anticipating collaborative working. Yes, please.
Hi, Jonathan. There's
only
this kind of interesting tension, I think, along two kind of different axes in terms of technical, about the adoption or the use of technical stuff by humanists. So one is, to what degree do people use kind of big infrastructural things, and to what degree do people use sort of small kind of tool, you know, bits and pieces?
That's a huge. It's a trust. It's an issue of trust, I think. The plain answer is we don't know.
So what I was wondering was you're in a fantastic position having spoken to people, and obviously you don't have kind of quantitative stats, but from a kind of qualitative thing, is it your impression that most of the tools, because clearly our work practices have changed dramatically over the past 20 years, and I'd be really interested to know to what degree people have focused on using big tools versus small ones, and to what degree people have decided to adopt tools from elsewhere, not within the humanities, and to what degree they use humanities-specific tools as well. So within those kind of four quadrants that, you know, are people using small tools they picked up from outside of the humanities, are they using big ones built in the humanities, are they using, you know, or vice versa, big tools which are from outside?
All kinds of tools.
Right.
Yes, it was, the answer is varied largely. They
right.
use all kinds of tools, or they don't use any.
Right.
So there's no concrete answer to your question, but I have the same question too. I was actually wondering the other day, I mean, if this infrastructure happens, say if it gets implemented, if there's a Daria thing that includes all sorts of tools, all sorts of services, or many, would people use it, or would they go back to a tool they've learned back when they were younger? We don't know. I don't know.
Valentina, unless it's following on from that.
It's related to the I just wondered if it wasn't also a question of time, actually, and where you are in the research process that will also dictate to some extent the kinds of tools that you use. And initially, you might be engaged more broadly with your community, but then when you enter sort of that later, in the concluding stages of research, you might withdraw to your own sort of, you know, world to do the kind of the final writing up or sort of process. So it might be a question of time when people can move from the tool types.
I would say that when people search, when people look for information, they use established small tools. They use Google. That's what everybody says. We Google. But when you move to more later stages of research. Of course, things happen simultaneously, right? You search throughout your research, but when you move to annotating or marking up your work or organizing it, then you may be more open to new things. That's my impression from the interviews. They were more. They were on. Shakier ground when it came to enriching the information they found with their own ideas, or rearranging it, or sharing it, than when they had to actually find it. They felt safer when they, in the process of, in the primitive of searching, was a safer area. Is a safer area for humanities researchers. They know how to find things. They just sometimes they're unsure what to do with it once they have it.
Really interesting thing here is it's not only have you got a collaboration between the technologists and the humanists, in this case the classicists, but also the social scientists. Because this is a this type of research is right up their stream. When I send my dissertation students to the library when they don't understand the research process, you always have to send them to the social sciences section of the library, not to the humanities section, because that's where you get the books on how to do a literature review, how to do interviews, how to actually conduct research.
Mind you, though,
to the social sciences
section. Mind you that if we had to do the same kind of research on social scientists, the job would have been much easier. They use statistical tools. They use quantitative tools.
Yes.
Humanists don't.
Yeah, mine is actually a very basic question. I just wanted to know if the findings of the interviews are public, are going to be public, just you know if you have questions and answers.
You mean the actual material?
Yeah.
It's not public, but if you need any of it, I can give you access rights.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. For me, for example, in the tools questions, I'd like to see
the actual questions. I can give you a couple of papers that I can send you a couple of papers we wrote on the design and the actual interview. But if you want to listen to the interviews, yes, we can arrange that.
And are you planning to interview more people?
No, this project is finished, this preparatory phase of this project. But we are now DCU and myself, we are now part of another project, ERIE. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's European Holocaust Research Infrastructure. So we're going to be doing more interviews, more focused on Holocaust researchers. These people are sociologists, they can be politics researchers as well as historians and so on, archivists. So yes, we're going to be doing more interviews but with a different focus, and we're also going to be doing a web survey so that we can get to have statistical results as well, not just qualitative results. So we're going to do semi-structured interviews for ERIE as well as a web survey. This is being designed as we speak.
You gave this in English. Is English the language of your research?
Yes, to English.
Everybody
spoke in English, and the deliverables were English.
And interviews were?
Some of them were English, some of them were Greek.
As you were saying, this kind of the sociological analysis, it goes back a very long way in the hard sciences and the social sciences, a lot of people looked into which research subdisciplines flourished and which faded away and why. So all that kind of thing's been done already. And I'd be very upset if your sample wasn't reasonably statistically serious, which it isn't. In a way it seems to me you might, by not doing that, by putting that aside, you may have turned up questions which aren't typical of the whole community. I don't know what the whole community would number, but it'll be several hundred.
Yes, we didn't do that. We didn't do a survey. We just did...
You did talk about empirical research, which sort of ages it.
I guess it's focused down on an identifiable cohort of people who were.
I don't know why Daria chose to do it that way. It was my personal choice, obviously.
Process.
But yes, it was just how Daria described its work, exactly like that. Qualitative research, interviews, up to 30 interviews.
Well, a couple of questions. Are you familiar with a project called Implementing New Knowledge Environments?
No.
It's a Canadian. Project. That has been doing very similar research actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I was involved with Claire Warwick at the Center for Digital Humanities on a year postdoc looking at reader experience, and another part of the group was looking at research processes
mm-hmm.
as well, based in Canada, doing similar
mm-hmm.
some online and interviews.
Yeah.
Yes, all the our categories were students,
mm-hmm.
researchers, and also general public, but looking at text objects more and how.
No, I'm not aware of that.
So it might be
yes.
worth tapping into that, and I can give you...
yes, please. It will be helpful while we design the ERIE.
I think there might be some interesting... the particular category in your kind of workflow... what was the category? Information object.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was sort of engagements with information objects that we were working on in particular, and again, through interviews, and getting lots of... qualitative data in any way that you
yes,
say.
Yes, please do. Could you share that with me?
To manage. But I think this question about the statistical side is interesting. But what we were finding in measuring these different ways in which people worked, where they were reading, what they were reading, what kinds of tools or devices or books to handle, that everyone had such different variable ways of working that were so contingent
mm-hmm.
and particularistic and based on age and gender and their commute and whether you're a part-time full-time, so you're raising a family, so you're researching on the floor and
mm-hmm,
follow-up
mm-hmm.
things more hard copy than because you don't have time to leave the kids, get to the computer. All these different things impinged on the research process, and I just wonder if statistically you might get results, but they might be more an artifact of that statistical method rather than saying anything meaningful about the way that people actually work on the ground.
How many people did you deal with? Then 2400, did you?
Yes, I had 10, 15, and 8 from these different categories.
33.
So, and it was harder to get a hold of some, the results were impacted by that. It was hard to get your students and the non-academics to get them involved in the research. Despite my attempts at bribery and things,
mm-hmm.
but it was the more time we could have got up to the numbers and maybe started to get more statistically meaningful information, I suppose, depending on the questions asked. But I just wonder about because the ways in which we work are so variable, maybe unless we're in a lab context, that.
So you can't make statistical conclusions.
I just wondered. Yeah. But anyway, I'll
yes,
let you know
please
more
do. Yes, thank you.
One thing that struck me looking at your slides, it's disappeared that one,
which
the one with your little squares on it, was the format. I didn't hear any mention of any open formats in these. You mentioned the Word documents and the usual suspects of proprietary software. But if this was going to be opened up, it might have been a better policy to have used open tools. open document formats rather than proprietary ones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's something to think about,
yeah.
I guess, for later stages of
yes.
it, I think. Do you have any comment on that with your work?
I think the key thing about this is how do you take the work you've done via federated ownership, I think they were buzzword.
The burning issue always is going to be sustainability. This is a first.
Oh.
Nobody
wants to touch
that.
Okay. Not even developers.
Okay, so the funding is finished for this stage of the project, and then it's going over to actually building the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now the structure is going to be very different at this later stage, because you get this project was funded by the EU. S3. It was an FP7 project, but now you have to have national country money in. So it's going to be rearranged largely by the amount of money each country is willing to put in this project, to invest for it. So there's been this whole big discussion about whether national input is going to be is going to depend on the GDP of each country involved and so on. So in this case, Greece.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And is there a third phase? Okay. So the research has
been
done. Then you're going to have the infrastructure built. And what's the third phase going to be?
Curating
it. So that's going to be the sustainability issue.
Exactly.
I think we should let Aggie Artis off the hook. She will still be hanging around for a little while later. But I think we should thank her now for coming all the way, especially to see us and talk to us.
Thank you.